Robert Randolph presents the Slide Brothers' No Cheap Seats in Heaven. Van Morrison from Moving On, Skiffle, Streamline Train, and it was San Fermin with No Devil from Jackrabbit. Greg here, it's Undercurrents, back with Danielle Ponder in just a minute.
This grinding stone has been passed down from my great, 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 great grandmothers.
They shouldn't be embarrassed of what their culture is.
It was very, very discouraging as a young person to be so in love with books that had only white characters as their protagonists.
Now, like how we live in our society, we are less connected to our culture, I feel.
Some people ask me, "Oh, you're living, you live in two worlds." I say, make a one. You make two worlds. Where's the other one? You're confused. This is one world. Don't forget who you are.
Indigenous Youth Nation.
Coming soon on NV1 and PRX. It's Undercurrents, coming to you with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Friends of Undercurrents.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre, a place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.FM, where we make musical structures for the listener.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Today, we're going to talk about money, and this is just something that's on everybody's mind so much of the time. And our attitudes towards money can shape our well-being, according to our guest today. It's easy to feel overwhelmed by issues around money, plagued by feelings of scarcity, bewildered by the complexities of building wealth, and frustrated by the persistent sense that no matter how much we earn, something important still feels missing. But what if the key to financial freedom isn't found in striving for more, but in redefining what enough truly means? There's so much more to life than chasing financial success. Today's guest offers guidance for cultivating a life of meaning, balance, and fulfillment. Our guest is Elizabeth Husserl, author of the new book, The Power of Enough, Finding Joy in Your Relationship with Money. Elizabeth is a registered investment advisor, a financial advisor, and co-founder of Peak 360 Wealth Management, a boutique wealth planning firm. She holds a BS in economics from Tulane and an MA in East-West psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies, where she's also taught as an adjunct professor. Her experience spans nonprofit work throughout the Americas, and she's a highly sought-after speaker, and we are honored to have her on a Pathway show today. Elizabeth lives in San Francisco with her husband and daughter. Well, hello, Elizabeth, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Oh, my goodness, Paolo. I'm so excited and happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start by talking about money. And specifically, what is the... You give some great definitions in this book, yeah. And I want to give you a chance to share that. Because what's the... For instance, yeah. What's the difference between money and wealth?
Yeah, it's a huge one. So I'm so glad we're starting here because that's kind of one of the core beliefs that I'm just tackling head on in chapter one. And the core difference is that money's a tool and wealth is a state of being, right? A state of being connected to well-being. And so this is really important because we can often mistake money as the end outcome for wealth. In reality, it's a tool that we use in so many different functions. And it can't define it, but unfortunately, we let it define us. And so it starts to taint our experience of wealth. And so what the journey I embarked on, because it took me 10 years to write this book, and it's filled with my own personal experience and client experiences, was I was asking this question: why is it that you know, in countries like the United States, we have so much and yet we feel poor. What is that? What's at the core root of feeling like we're lacking, right? If we can start to redefine what wealth is, we're able to experience wealth, embody wealth, and not just try to accumulate something that can feel very abstract. And that's why money feels so confusing and so amorphous and so conflictive, is that it's an abstract tool that sometimes is taken out of proportion in our lives. And so my book is an invitation to separate the two, right? And to take time diving into our relationship to wealth and our relationship to money, but understanding them for what they are. And there's a spaciousness that I feel like readers walk away with, or clients walk away with, when I'm having these conversations. And there's an invitation for us to talk more about it. Because I think that's the hard thing, Paolo, is that we don't talk enough about money. We don't talk enough about wealth because we use it as comparison tools. We feel bad if we have it, bad if we don't. Someone has more than me. And the invitation through the book, and especially through these mini moments, is to ask deeper questions. Right? What makes up our experience of wealth? Who was I as a little kid? What was I dreaming, right? What do I want to pass on to my family? What brings me joy and a sense of fulfillment? So there's some deeper personal growth and just humanity questions that we can ask, and they're at our fingertips.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing how you touch on this in the book. You go in really deep, you know, and a core premise of the book is that wealth is not just about what you have. It's about who you are, and that whole embodiment aspect. We got to talk about that today. You know, it's like, I think people are very confused about money because they, you know, to some extent, religion might have played a part, you know, like money is the root of all evil. You know, how is that a misinterpretation?
Well, so I think, so religion aside, I think what's so confusing about money is we misuse its function as a tool, right? So money has four main functions, and we've known this since Aristotle, right? It's a measure of value. It's a medium of exchange. It can store value for future use. And it's a medium of credit, right? That it's a tool. I mean, think technology, think your iPhone. It's a tool. But what happens, so if we go back in time and we lived in smaller communities, we used currency, and it wasn't just money as we know now. It was shells and beads and cigarettes and stone and all these different objects that we use for currency to exchange. But we had intimate relationships with each other. And that's the key piece that sometimes we miss in our modern society, is because we lack the same level of intimacy in our communities, money becomes a tool that has replaced an exchange of trust, right? Yeah. I don't know you, but if you flash a dollar, if you flash a $100 bill, or you flash a fancy credit card, I start to make assumptions of who you are and are you trustworthy, right? We have a credit score. Are you trustworthy? And so that's when it's gotten really confusing. And that's where we've allowed it to define our sense of self-worth, right? I'm a financial advisor. I talk about money all day long with clients, and I make an active effort to not say net worth. Because again, in our psyche, we connect net worth to self-worth. We talk about asset size. We talk about liabilities. Let's call things for what they are. But when we start to connect it to worth, that's when we're like, ugh, it doesn't feel good. And so if we separate and say, okay, money, you have a role over here, and it is my responsibility to like look at my spreadsheet, plan what's going in, going out. I need to know how to be a financially responsible adult. But money, you don't define me, much like my husband doesn't define me or my kid doesn't define me, but I need to know my place in my relationship with them. We don't want to be in an anxious attachment or a codependent. Like, we all know relationship styles don't work if they have anxiety or attachment or things that, you know, just make them shadowy. So it's the same thing with money. If we know what a right relationship to money is and we're working with it, we can turn towards the bigger questions, which is what comprises our experience of wealth. And this is a key point. Like, one of my mentors, who Lynn Twist, who wrote The Soul of Money 20 years ago, hopefully she's been on your show at some point, but she wrote The Soul of Money, and her contribution was around sufficiency, which was so important, right? She talks about how sufficiency is claiming I have enough with the resources I have. I take it one step further and I talk about satiation. I feel enough. And those are two different things. That's the mind center says, I have enough, and they're making the plan. The body center, the somatic wisdom, is knowing that I feel enough. And that's a different starting point in how we experience wealth.
You know, you redefined success as satiation.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about that, because you have this satiation paradigm in contrast to the abundance scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear more about that, and what steps did you take to get there?
So obviously, like, again, I've been on this journey for 20 years. And so one of the ways to counteract scarcity is through abundance, right? And their abundance mindset that was made popular with the habits of seven habits of successful people. But think of it this way. I'm pushing scarcity away with one hand and I'm grasping to abundance with the other hand, right? I'm overcompensating a feeling of lack by wanting more than enough. That's abundance in itself still puts us in a place of tension. And for years, Paulo, I was like, wait a second, that doesn't quite feel like the solution that's sustainable or long-term. And so I started just kind of practicing, like, what happens if I just like relax my hands and I'm not pushing, I'm not grasping? What does that look like? And I started to be like, what are those moments that feel, what are those moments in my day and in my life where I feel satisfied? I feel content. I feel like I love my life. And I didn't earn one more dollar, right? I didn't get one more client. I just am in right alignment with the different parts of myself. And so I went in a different direction. And I started studying some economists who talked about human needs and went back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I realized if we were to just kind of like accept the fact that we all have core common human needs, right? So human needs are universal, but the way we satisfy them is unique and personal. We start to realize our definition of wealth is really more how well are we satisfying our needs, one, and two, how well are we designing strategies to satisfy our needs that don't have anything to do with money? That's what breaks our dependency on money, right? And so as we start to talk about it, it's like I'm satisfying the need for participation, purpose, understanding, connection, touch, physical health, financial stability, what are my not monetary strategies and what are my non-monetary, non-financial strategies to make sure I'm living a fulfilled life? And then taking the time, and I go into this in chapter one, to literally stop and consume a moment of satiation, right? And we know what that feels like. We all know what a moment with a good nourishing meal, or like I look at your background and I can smell the ocean and I can feel the sunlight on my skin. And I know if I stop and it's not just smell the roses, but then digest and integrate that moment of satiation and fulfillment, you can start to compound moments of meaning in your body, much like we compound interest in a portfolio. That's how our portfolios grow, right? Is compounding interest. The same thing, if we compound those moments of meaning, memory, dividends in our body, we start to teach our body something different, because what's really important, you know, this was talked about in the book, The Scarcity Brain. We are wired to seek, right? Scarcity has a role in our life. It has what's kept us alive. It allows us to look for food, to look for shelter, to keep our loved ones safe. So our mind is wired to seek. And how do we best help our mind know that we've had enough is listening to the cues of our body to when we can feel fulfillment and feel satiated. And the body can help the mind start to relax and know what enough is.
You know, this to me, what this means is you are personalizing the definition of wealth, and you're recommending that people do that. Okay, what makes you feel satisfied? What makes you feel wealthy? You know, another way of putting, or what is your love language? You know, that's the other, that's a system for defining what makes you happy, instead of going with this like left brain quantitative comparative metric, which is just, you know, your financial net worth, the number. So it does seem to me that there's a left brain, right brain. You're encouraging people to develop their intuition, their right brain as a way of experiencing things, with the primacy of feeling, and you know what makes you feel satisfied. I don't think most people ask that question. often enough.
No, and I would say it's different than asking the question, what makes you happy, right? Because I could sit down and say, you know what? A Manhattan makes me happy. But if I drink too many of them, my body's like, oh, you're overly satisfied. You know what I mean? And so whereas I'm like, yeah, that broccoli doesn't necessarily make me happy, but my body's happy after I eat it. So do you see that? Or my body's content. And so I think there's a way in which it's starting to, like, I think the easiest example is the difference between eating a really nourishing meal that you're like, oh, that hit the spot and I feel good after it versus empty calories or junk food where, you know, you may have gotten a hit of taste buds, but then you feel like crap afterwards, right? And so I think that's the key piece, is starting to track what are those things that bring lasting compounding dividend, right? So in the financial world, dividend is you're paying an income on your investment, right? It's the income that's being paid forward. So the same thing, the more we learn how to see what are those things that satiate us, they pay income in our bodies, and we build dividends going forward, not just in our own lives, but in those around us, right? So for me, it's interesting, and it is unique. Like I have this conversation all the time with my husband. A lot of my satisfiers are relational. I love relationships and I love people and I love meaningful interactions. My husband loves ideas, and he could sit and just chat with ChatGPT about philosophy all day long. And that's where he wants to go, right? Whereas if I'm like knocking on his door and be like, babe, it's time for dinner. He's like, coming. And so the way that we satisfy our needs is different. And I think that's where we start to feel agency, right? There is no one cookie cutter recipe for wealth. And that's really important, because people are often looking for that magic pill.
Now, I don't know whether this is kind of a male-oriented personality trait, but we like to measure things. We like to compete. We like to know how we stack up. You know, it's on. You know, like if you do like the, you know, news feed through Google or something like that, there's always articles about where do you rank with the middle class in your state, or, you know, in celebrity net worth. And there's just so much. There's all of these metrics, and men, I think men are really attracted to that. I know I was when I was an entrepreneur. Somebody taught me how to do a cash flow projection spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was such a valuable tool. Yeah. I've used it ever since, you know, but I always knew what I was making on a daily basis and versus what I was spending. It's kind of hard to get away from that mentality. You know, it's sort of like, well, you know, if you're independently wealthy and you're living off of a passive income, I say, oh yeah, I could do this embodied wealth thing. But if not, you know, it's kind of hard not to compare.
But it's so interesting, because like, so one of the exercises that I give in the book called the Wealth Mandala is a very clear metrics, right? So for people who like metrics, I like metrics. I'm in spreadsheets all day long, right? That's what I do for my living. But the Wealth Mandala gives you a very clear visual map where you can see on a scale of 1 to 10, how full is that spoke on the wheel that has to do with that need? And I can't tell you how many times I do that exercise with people and they're like, whoa, check it out. I'm feeling total lack in belonging. I'm feeling total lack in participation. I've done nothing to contribute to my community. And guess what? When I see that like that, and even though maybe my financial stability piece of the pie is high or my physical health, I can start to really see what's at the core of this nagging feeling that we often have inside, that we haven't done enough or earned enough or haven't been successful enough, right? Because we know that's there. And to your point, we can feel it. But what I'm trying to do is help people get clarity around, oh, that's the area that I'm lacking, right? I was working with one of my executive clients, and again, they're financially independent, but he's still working because he loves to work. And we did this Wealth Mandala exercise, and he was a 2 out of 10 in the area of touch. And you could see he just wanted to break down in tears. He's like, oh my gosh, this is my worst nightmare, because this is where I keep all my shame. And I'm like, great, our work is only half done. I can be a financial advisor and say, yes, I can create an income plan for you for your investments. But if you're not feeling wealthy in all these other areas, again, what's the point? And so by getting super clear, what are those metrics that maybe you're a 2 out of 10 and you're like, what is it going to take for me to get to be a 3 out of 10, a 5 out of 10? You can play that game if you want, right? Because, you know, we can create metrics and games and satiation units, but the core idea is getting crystal clear and then taking responsibility for where you feel lack Because what we end up doing is that we scapegoat money, we blame money, you're not earning enough, or people want too much from me. Because it doesn't matter if you have too little or too much. If you have too little or stress about earning it, paying taxes, all that, paying bills. If you have too much, you're stressed about paying taxes, paying bills, and people wanting stuff from you. Like, the problems don't go away. They just look different.
For sure. Oh, for sure. Why is it so uncomfortable for people to talk openly about money, with even with their friends?
I mean, I think you nailed it, is that it's a comparative tool, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't like feeling... We don't like feeling less than, and we've made up that the person who has more money is more successful. So if someone reveals they have more money or less debt, and it just does not feel good. So we don't do it enough. We don't talk in numbers, and knowing that we still have a long way to go as a society. Part of why I wrote this book, and had nothing to do with investment strategy or the traditional financial strategy, was to give people ways and questions to first ask themselves as personal inquiry and growth, and then have some questions that they can ask family members and close friends so they can talk about wealth in a way that doesn't necessarily require them talking about numbers. And let's see what that does. Because I wanted people to have a different entry point.
You know, I know how important and helpful it has been to me to be able to talk openly about it, because after I sold my company, I was all of a sudden wealthy overnight. Yeah. And oh my God, it was overwhelming. It was unbelievable. Everybody wanted to be my friend, and everybody was bringing me, you know, cockamamie business proposals and what have you. And that was really hard. It really made it difficult for me to just to trust, you know, it brought up trust issues. But it was good that I found a good advisor, and you know, and mm-hmm. I have some friends that I can talk to about it. Do you think that's a good idea for people to make an effort to talk about it?
100%. I mean, because think of it this way: there's two things I would say to that. There is a whole phenomenon called the sudden wealth syndrome, which is what you were describing, right? Like,
there's
a windfall, mm-hmm. an inheritance, a sale of a company, etc. Big acquisition,
winning the lottery,
right? less common, but yes, a windfall occurs, and what happens, it's a shot of vitality that is very disorienting, right? It's a shot of vitality that's disorienting to you or whoever goes through it, because you're like, whoa, how much did my life really change, right? And then it's disorienting in the way that it impacts the relationships of those in your life, right? And, oh, are they still my true friend, or do they want something from me? I mean, these are all the conversations I have with clients all day long. And so one of the common advices is that when you go through a windfall event like that is, you know, to give yourself a period of time, 6 months, 1 year, to not make any big decisions, and literally say, okay, money, we just got into an arranged marriage. I don't know you in this level. Let's get to know each other first before we make big decisions, right? And I think that's part of it, is like clearing the interference of other people's ideas of what to do with it, and be like, okay, you and I, money, need to know each other at this different level. And then the second piece that's really important is that when I said that money is a shot of vitality, it literally is like a life force that comes in that you have to digest and integrate and start to get super clear on how you want to channel that resource through the world. And again, if you lean on a tool like the Wealth Mandala, when you're like, okay, overnight, my financial spoke or piece of the pie just got really full and I have an overflow of resources, which needs do I want to channel the excess to? And that's where wealth really starts to get connected to meaning, right? A lot of people are like, I just got a lot of money. Let me just do a charitable donation and reduce my taxes, right? Like there's kind of like some strategies to do, but be like, you know what? Let me just pause for a second. What are these areas that I want to address in my life and in those closest to me? And it just becomes a different conversation.
You know, speaking of conversations, you were just hinting at, well, you were just alluding to a conversation one might have with money itself. And so you teach a sort of a gestalt process where your client has a conversation with money, money's sitting in the chair, and then you switch. You know, how does that work, and how does that help people?
I mean, like any therapeutic empty chair exercise, which is this gestalt exercise, it helps people put words to what they're feeling in a way that can help bring clarity, right? And so the empty chair exercise gives you the opportunity to work through unresolved emotions with In this case, we're working with money. It could be a parent, though. It could be someone in your life who just like, I'm really feeling triggered and I don't know how to work through this. And so it's a very simple exercise, and you can do it, you know, after listening to this, where you literally, you grab something that represents money to you. It can be your wallet, a dollar bill, a credit card. The younger generation grabs their phone because they pull up apps, right? And so whatever represents money to you, you put it in front of you on a chair. Sometimes I go to my meditation cushions and I just sit in front of money. You put a timer on the phone, you get the first 5 minutes, and you just get to vent. Like, what are you feeling about money? And it's not the story, Paolo, because money's in a relationship with you. It knows your stories, but what are you feeling, right? And so it can be like, ugh, like I'm so overwhelmed by all these decisions I have to make. And I don't need more to start. Da, 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 da. Or money, you represent to me. Or where have you been my whole life? Or, oh, it's great to see you, right? Like you literally let, you kind of personify what would you say to money if it walked in the door and sat down in front of you. Then when the timer goes off, you switch chairs and money gets the opportunity to respond to you. And that's the fun part, because you get to see what would money say. If that's too much of a stretch, then it can be the part of you that deals with money every day responding to the part of you that maybe doesn't deal with money and that you want a little more cooperation. You take a turn each twice, and then you're like, the invitation isn't so much to see what needs to be fixed or what needs to be resolved. This is less a fix-it strategy. It's more like, oh, what's the core emotion there that I can take responsibility for?
We're just about running out of time, but there was something that came up in a conversation I was having last night with a good friend of mine who is going through the transition from retirement to living off of passive income. And I know this too. I've gone through this and I'm going through it. It's sort of like, it's a weird transition. And do you help people do that? I mean, because you're used to making money. You're used to earning. You're used to achieving. You're used to, you know, competing in the marketplace successfully, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you sell the business or whatever, and you don't have to achieve anything anymore. You're living off of passive income. It's enough, but it's a weird change of, you know, all you're doing then is writing checks to the gardeners and the, mm-hmm. you know, the handyman, et cetera. So how do you help people make that transition?
Yeah. So I first and foremost frame it as that if we're playing the infinite game, we're never retiring from life. And that's a key piece, right? Playing the finite game, you retired and you're like, now what, right? I feel useless. I don't feel, you know, valuable anymore. Like it's a huge identity crisis. But if you're playing the infinite game, where the game is to be in relationship to your creativeness and your innovation, that doesn't stop. Even when you like, yes, you sold the business, that chapter closed, but you're still producing this radio show. You're still participating in creativity. You're still doing, and you know, we just got to meet each other, but that doesn't, your relationship to your vitality does not stop the day you retire, but it does change forms. And I think that's the key piece. And I think the piece is that, you know, it's kind of like if you've ever had kids leave the house, your relationship to your child doesn't change, but you graduate from that stage and you have to find intimacy and vitality in different ways. It's very similar, but we can't give our power away when we retire. We have to stay connected to vitality.
I think a lot of the times the problem is that the person who's retiring or sold the business doesn't know how to do anything else. And they're not allowed to do that anymore because they can't compete. Hey, we have basically run out of time. And I just want to thank you so much for being, there's so much more we could talk about. I mean, your book's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, especially I love the part about learning how to say no, about boundaries. There's so much valuable information in here, how to write your money story. But I just want to thank you for being on the show. Maybe we'll do it again because there's so much more we could explore. So thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me. I'll come back anytime.
And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.elizabethhusserl. How do you pronounce your last name?
So it's Husserl.
Husserl. Okay. Yeah. ElizabethHusserl.com. That's Elizabeth with a Z and Husserl, Husserl. Yes. And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview anytime you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Elizabeth Husserl, author of The Power of Enough, Finding Joy in Your Relationship with Money. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific time. And even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled divination.com, as well as Paulo's YouTube channel and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Elizabeth Husserl and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my